however long you want.
I'm Judy, I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Judy.
Hi, thank you so much for having a New Day group here. As you can see, I got a sunburn today. And yes, I think you could fry an egg on my face. And I'm going to keep talking anyway. It's so great to be here. My sobriety date is November 26th, 1993. Yesterday. That's how I think of it, you know? It feels like yesterday. And it always feels like yesterday. I was just telling somebody who just reached 2 years that it was always going to feel like it was yesterday. There's a story by one of the pioneers in here, one of the women, and she talks about back decades ago when there weren't that many women in the program and when they were still new. She talks about people experiencing their arrestment. And that's what they called not drinking or having some time, experiencing their arrestment. So let me tell you about my arrestment, or before my arrestment. I had my first drink when I was 14. A friend of mine later told me that she was there and saw it, and she said I drank it too fast and I liked it too much. I wish she had told me that then, but I think she did probably try to tell me a lot of things that I didn't listen to. I was at a party where I was with people who were kind of preppy, and I had just come from a public school lifestyle, and I felt kind of chubby and not that great looking and didn't know these people, but my mom really wanted me to get to know these people because she wanted to get to know their mothers. So I went to the party and I hoped that I was, you know, at least adequate. And somebody put a rum and tonic in my hand. And from that moment on, all I remember about that party was that I was sitting in a chaise, you know, like a beach chaise, out on this patio, and I was telling jokes like I was Joan Rivers, and I was feeling like I looked like Rita Hayworth. And if you're too young for that reference, Beyonce. I basically remember feeling like I was the queen of the party. And all it took was that rum and tonic. And that's the drink I chased for 26 years. Even though my circumstances 26 years later didn't look like that at all, but I was still going for that change of personality that was going to make me fit in. I pretty much let drinking take over my social life as a teenager, but I thought everybody was doing that. And when I remember now even being a child, I remember playing bar with a friend of mine. One would be the patron and one would be the bartender, and we'd say to each other, "Would you like a creme de menthe?" You know, like it was very sophisticated. So I don't know if non-alcoholics play bar games like that when they're kids. But anyway, and I also remember a lady from my childhood who, when my mother was, you know, shopping with gloves on and making peas and hamburgers, she was, this lady in our neighborhood was playing Ray Charles records in a really dark den with a drink in her hand, and I remember loving to watch her do that. So there was some kind of friendly feeling I had toward people who were drinking, or maybe just toward fantasy, and that kind of stuck with me. My grades did go down at some point when it was time to go to college. I didn't really do anything about applying, so at some point, I went to visit someone who was in a school, and it was not a great school, and I said, "Would you take me?" And they said, "Yes." So that's the college I went to. And the friends I had usually were looking for people to buy a bottle with on weekends, so those were the friends I had. And the dates I had, I don't even know where they came from or where they went, but there was probably a bottle involved. In fact, when I think back about my earlier years drinking, the only way you can connect why I was here doing this with those particular people is if you connect the bottles. If you connect the bottles, you'll know why I was there. And when I got to be about 26 and I had been, I'd already, my parents showered me with opportunities. At one point, I didn't know what to do next, and they sent me to Paris to work for the company my dad was affiliated with. And all I had to do was answer the phone and say, "Allô," you know. And, you know, some days I called in sick. But I thought that if I went to France, I would be a normal drinker. I would fit in because they drank at lunch and everything else. But even in France, people were telling, my friends were saying, "Judith, arrête, arrête, like stop, you know, stop. It's time to stop drinking," which really made me mad because it was France. And I used to try to tell that story always. My sponsor would, if she were here, my first sponsor would be saying, you know, make it a general country. Don't say France so people can identify. And then when I started saying I was in a foreign country, people ran up after the meeting and they'd say, "It was Iceland, right? I know that they drink so much there." But they drink everywhere, right? And so I came home from France. I didn't know what to do next. I had just become this person who never knew what to do next. And somehow, even though I was really happy being on my own, I still seemed to be leaning on mom and dad a lot. And my mother sent me to, she suggested that a place, they had a place in Vermont, and she suggested I apply as a, like a little tech worker. And so I did, and I met my husband to be there. We went from Killington to Stowe to Rutland and back all summer putting up shows. And I remember a couple of things. I remember that on the day we drove from one city to the next, all I could think about was, where's the liquor store between here and there so that I can be sure and have something if we have a party, right? But other people would get there with their groceries, their milk, and their bread, you know, and I'd have my bottle of Chianti or something. You know, I got it. But I was always looking for an opportunity to relax. And one day, another company came into town, and there was kind of a nice-looking guy, a nice tall guy, and he was leaning on something, and he was watching me, and he said, "Haven't you had enough?" And I thought, this guy would be perfect for me, because he would put me to bed and when I passed out, and he would be perfect for me because my mother can't be around forever, and he would be perfect for me because he cares. And so about a month after that, and he was an actor, so what do you call an actor without a girlfriend? Homeless. So I said I would support him and go wherever he wanted, but what I really meant was, take me with you wherever you're going. And so we went to a pewter pot in Boston, and I suggested that if we got married, people would give us furniture. And my husband thought that was a good idea. So we got married, and neither of us wanted to be an adult. And I sort of tried to, I think it kept my drinking at bay for a while, that he was out of work a lot, like he never acted. And I thought he was going to be away all the time so I could behave as I liked, you know? So don't always trust what your fantasy tells you. But I had this dream that my husband was going to, he was going to really make it big, and we were going to go to Beverly Hills, and he was going to get me a house in Beverly Hills, and then I wouldn't have to work, and he would go away on acting assignments for months at a time, and we would have a pool in back, and I would pursue a writing career sitting in a chaise lounge like the one I was in when I was 14, and I would have a very good-looking pool boy. And when I came to AA years later, my sponsor said that every fantasy I had booze in the heart of it. If you take away the pool boy, you take away the Beverly Hills, you take away the house, you take away the not working and the writing, you've got that Long Island iced tea, you know, in my hand. Anyway, my husband didn't have a career takeoff, so I went from job to job to job. It was really drinking money for me. Every time I left the house, I was probably going to get money to come home and watch Law and Order reruns and drink. And my husband was not a drinker. And so for years we had this routine where, you know, we'd watch TV and I'd put two glasses out. I'd pour wine in mine and wine in his. He wasn't a drinker, so I'd drink mine, then I'd drink his. And that's pretty much what was going on in 1993 when my life started to change, but I couldn't tell anybody. I started to see things that weren't there. At one point I said, "Did you see that black cat cross the living room?" And he said, "We're on the 13th floor, we don't have a cat." I was like, "I saw a cat. I saw that cat." I also at one point wrote to the wine company saying that since they put sulfites in the booze, I was getting itchy and they should take them out. But I later learned that that was the DTs that I was having. It wasn't their fault. There was a day that I was coming home from a job and I was maintaining at that point. So it was maybe a little late, the subway was a little late, and I was racing to get a bottle and go home. And I got something at the liquor store, I got a bottle, and I was always looking in my purse for $3.62 or something. I noticed in sobriety, I never go, "Can I afford that butter? Do I have $3.62? It was only the booze that I had to do that for. And so I was coming home, and I was racing home, and I dropped the bottle. And I dropped it near a New York kind of grape, and it just spilled. And I panicked, and I ran back to the liquor store, and I demanded a new bottle. Like it was a defective bottle. And they gave it to me. And they gave it to me because I had spent a lot of time buying wine in their store, I guess. Or I looked crazy. But anyway, I just remember getting upstairs and, just like, if the elevator doesn't come, and, and putting it on the kitchen counter and getting it open and getting a little, and then that, which I haven't had to experience that through alcohol, but I've had a lot of moments like that in the last 29 and a half years where I felt that way about something spiritual going on. But it was not a good time in my life, and I thought maybe somebody I knew might be an alcoholic, so I went to Al-Anon first. And they said that I should go to an AA meeting so that I would be able to recognize an alcoholic when I saw one. And I went, and I thought, "Oh, these poor people can't drink." I went home and had one for you. I just could not imagine what would that be like. I mean, what would it be like? What kind of world could I live in where I couldn't look forward to a drink? And I had one other episode that was upsetting that I remember tonight. Which was a friend of mine wanted me to be a matron of honor at her wedding, and we went out to Long Island on the train from Manhattan. And anyway, we went out, and there was a lot of booze. And on the way home on the Long Island Railroad, if any of you have ever been up there, it pulls into the city with a kind of a jerk and
snap action.
Thank you. Okay. And so when it pulled in, I threw up all over the seat in front of me. And I had been the matron of honor that day, proper and dressed up. And I saw a look on my husband's face that even now I remember. And it was disgust. And I was so embarrassed and humiliated after I saw that look, that we walked in silence down 8th Avenue toward where we lived. And I thought, I don't even know, how do you like finesse this? How do I like move on from that moment? So I said to him, "David, that's it. No more weddings. They're too exciting. They get me wound up." I didn't even consider saying no more alcohol. So anyway, I did eventually have a bad moment where I found myself at AA right after, which was a good moment. I was looking out the window one day and considering quitting the job I was in, which I always did eventually. I always quit. I don't know if I quit before they fired me or if I quit when I just didn't feel like it was worth going in. I always said something like, I'm going to pursue poetry or something. I always said some stupid reason why I was leaving work for good. But yeah, I didn't want to go to work, and I looked out from where we lived. You could almost see the bus station, and I saw somebody I would have then called a bag lady, but now I think might have been one of us, and she was drinking something that looked like a bottle of vodka, and then I could see her kind of slipping down to the ground, and it was morning, and I thought, God, that looks good. That's what I want. And you know, I thought, if I just left my husband and my apartment and my stupid job, I could live like that. Maybe I could find a good corner to panhandle. Anyway, I realized that that was insane. And I went back to one more meeting. And then just after that was Thanksgiving, so I'll move on here. Just after that, it was Thanksgiving. I had been somebody who cooked and brought family in for the parade early in our marriage, but now it was no cooking, no parade. I got up that day, and every day had become like the next day and the last day. And I don't know if you've had that feeling, but just the, you know, that sand in your mouth, and oh God, I woke up again. And I didn't know why, because I had tried hard to do a lot of things. I'd been in therapy. I did a lot of things. And none of them worked out, and I didn't know why. And so my husband suggested we go downstairs to a restaurant and buy Thanksgiving dinner. And there was a restaurant on the first floor of our building. So we went in there, and I said to him before we went in, I'm not going to drink. It's just a Thursday. It's just Thursday lunchtime. I'm not going to drink just because they say that it's a holiday. I'm not going to drink. He's like, okay. Mm-hmm. And we got inside, and the waitress said, would you like a drink? And I said, sure. And that was my spiritual awakening. I realized for the first time in 26 years that that drink ordered me. I wasn't going to have a drink, but the drink wanted a drink. And the idea that I was controlled for all those years and didn't even know it made me so hoppin' mad. I went to a meeting the next day, and I realized that was, it's something different for everybody, but for me it was the idea that I had been controlled and didn't know it. There was something about that, you know, the defiant alcoholic. I just wasn't having it. And so I went to a meeting, and I heard later that I might have had my pajamas on. I don't know if that's true. But I just sat with my head against the wall and, you know, just tried to listen and heard people counting days. And there was a sign in front, which I was told was like an early Bill Wilson meeting sign that said, but for the grace of God. And of course, I didn't comprehend that at all. I looked at the steps and I thought, oh, I'll do the first part of one, I'll do three, looks easy. Let me do not four, not eight, no, definitely 10, maybe 12. I'll do those, because everything else looks really scary and humiliating. But on the third day at that meeting, so I had 3 days, and a lady came up to me, and she asked me if I wanted to go out for coffee. And I thought, whoa, she sees star potential. about 8 years later, after she'd met with me every Saturday for 8 years, taken me through the big book, I was celebrating my 8th anniversary, and I said, Chris, what was it that day that made you come over to me? And she said, no one else was talking to you. So it wasn't, you know, stardom. It was just a good AA, going up and welcoming somebody and offering to pass on the program. So I did join a home group, and I joined a strong traditions group. They functioned like I think New Day is becoming a strong traditions group now. I've been with them for a long time since I got to Virginia. But they functioned like a net, you know, and there were certain things going on. There were two-year service jobs, and, you know, once you mastered it, you were kicked to the next position, and once you got all the way through the positions, you worked your way to the bottom, you became the chairperson. And that's, then, you know, you went through everything else. You had to get speakers and fight with people and make up with people. And one particular thing I'll talk about with that before I move on. While my sponsor was taking me through the steps and the book, after we met at a meeting, the group was taking me through what it takes to keep a family together, you know. And one particular time when we had to get speakers and the guy who was supposed to do it with me didn't show up, I was mad and I said I wasn't going to speak to him again and he wasn't going to speak to me again, and we were all both looking for people to have our side at the meeting. And an old-timer man and an old-timer woman sort of pushed us together and said, "You two need each other. You know, say you're sorry." But I would have gone to Timbuktu rather than say I'm sorry. It's just, you know, that impulse that, you know, I'd rather be right than happy, you know, it just came over both of us, and we made up. But so many little spiritual awakenings happen in sobriety. And at the beginning, I remember a friend in my little beginner group, I had a beginner group too, he said that he had been just about to go get a drink, and he was waiting for the light to change, and a pickle truck drove up. And he had heard one of the old timers say that he was a pickle and he would never be a cucumber again. And the fact that the pickle truck drove up was a sign that he shouldn't drink. And these are the little things that become a spiritual awakening for a lot of us, at least for me, these tiny little synchronous moments that shouldn't have happened or might not have happened. Using the Serenity Prayer, these are just beginner things, but I was always late for the subway, and every day I was late, and then I would have to either tell my boss a fib or find some excuse. And then I suddenly realized, one day somebody suggested I use the Serenity Prayer, and I used the first part, I have to accept that I'm late, I have to accept the train is always leaving. And then one day I finally got to the second part. I could change the things I could. If I left my apartment 5 minutes earlier, that train would be pulling in when I got there. That to me was like a massively brilliant idea brought to me by AA. You know, just the idea that I could change me and everything else would change around me. And so stuff like that really grew, and service jobs and all of that, I'm very grateful for. And I was told when I had about 4 years, don't learn anything new. You know, that I had the basics. Just keep practice the basics. So the consistent use of the 12 steps is pretty much why I'm standing here today, plus having a home group and having friends that I can call, sponsors, when I can have them. There are a couple people here today. We're working together because our joint sponsor went to Maryland. And you know, I remember hearing stories like if you live on an island and you lose your sponsor, go to the mainland. Like, just find somebody that you can tell the truth to when you need to find your way back to the steps. And I wanted to talk for a minute about That's what it was like, and that's what happened. And I want to talk about a couple of things in the steps that were really important for me, because I'm not sure that everybody I've been talking to lately in AA seems to have been guided in this direction, or maybe they have, and I'm just not hearing it. But what I'm talking about today is step one, I had to keep deepening. So I would say today I'm still deepening step one. That is just deepening. I know more today that I'm an alcoholic than I knew when I first came in. I understand that I'm an alcoholic and I'm in a period of arrestment based on my spiritual condition. But step two Did I believe I was insane? It didn't really matter. I did believe that if I thought I wanted to change places with a bag lady, my thinking was definitely off. And my head was full of negatives. I think alcohol, for this alcoholic, alcohol just made everything bleak until there was just a little ball of bleakness in my head. You know, no more good thoughts and happy thoughts and exciting things like I'd had before. So when I got to, my sponsor was, my first sponsor was definitely an atheist, and she didn't make me get down on bended knee or anything, but there was a moment when I had a recovery job. I only had to work about two hours a day, but I had to face the public. And one day I walked in and I didn't think I had it in me to face the public. And I went into a restroom and I locked the door and I got down on my knees and I said, you know what, higher power, I can't do this meeting. I can't do that. So you are gonna have to do that. I'm gonna step back and you are gonna do it. And I think because I was on my knees, you know, something surrendered. And all I remember, a little like a blackout, I walked into that place, I said hi to everybody. I guess we had the meeting. It seemed like a good one. Everybody thanked me when they left. We had the meeting. And to me, that was such a great step three convincer that things will happen if I get out of the way and if I'm doing the right thing and if I'm sober and if I'm honest, open-minded, and willing. And then what I wanted to get at was this fourth step and fifth step. My sponsor had me do an asset list before she had me look at my defects of character. And when I came in, I didn't think I had any assets because, you know, I was down on myself and things hadn't gone well. And so I hadn't thought about assets. And she suggested taking like year 1 through 10 and 11 through 20 and just go in little increments in my life and write down if I was given an award, you know, for, you know, room monitor, or if I'd been given a role to sing in a little play, or anything as we went along. And at the end of my writing this down, I was 41, and I wrote it right up to 41, and she found some assets. She found that I had enthusiasm. She found that I had a musical voice, because there were a number of, they gave me this solo, they gave me that solo. She found that I had humor. She found that I was curious. You know, various things like this. And it planted in me the idea that the assets we were born with are there for us to polish, that we're here to polish those assets. I'd been mostly, you know, hiding those assets and drinking at everybody. And to the point where I didn't know I had assets, and I would sit in the meeting room like, if somebody wanted to talk in the meeting, what would I talk about? I'm not an expert in anything. They said, why don't you just listen? Is that okay to just listen? I don't have to be an expert. You know, so all of that phony stuff that was, you know, pay no attention to me. You know, like the Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. That had to go. That whole hologram of Judy, that whole Rita Hayworth on the chaise lounge, that had to go. And I just had to be plain old Judy like I was in the ninth grade, but with the assets that my higher power planted in me. And then she had me do my defect list. And it wasn't as bad as I thought, because she had done a lot of the things I had done. They all seemed to be pretty normal. But the most important inventory column that I've found when I'm working with people who have a number of years is the third column, which says, what instinct is being threatened? Because we all talk about fear a lot, but the big book has it laid out that if you inventory every resentment or fear or harm you think you've done, you're going to find that there's an instinct being threatened in that instance. And so it's a business kind of proposition. Well, you know, what am I trying to sell in the store that nobody's buying? Or, you know, what's preventing me from, Rob was saying on the car ride out here, that he there was something he didn't want to do because he felt that he had a certain limit. I had something like that happen this week where a friend was trying to teach me, a guy who knows a lot about real estate, was trying to teach me how to negotiate for an apartment. And I said, oh, I don't negotiate. I've never negotiated my whole life. And I just heard myself saying such things that had nothing to do with AA, like, I can't do it, I can't do it, I've never done it, but, you know, just on and on, like, trying to convince him that it was outside my capacities. It would have to be magic for it. You know, I'd have to be drunk again to do it or something. And so finally he put his face like almost right in my face and he said, it's a game. Negotiating for something. And I said, it's a game? Like, where have you been all my life? I had no idea that they're saying this and then you're saying that. I always thought, whatever people say, that's gospel, you know, and so it limited my life quite a bit because there were a lot of things I didn't want to even try because I didn't understand that they might be a game. And I think so all those years of drinking inhibited my, just my ability to be a human being with other people or to learn things that I didn't arrive with. Anyway, that, so the instincts being threatened, you know, my social instincts, security, sex instinct, personal relationships, those are in that third column. And if you get that third column in there, the fear just pretty much evaporates and you can find the defect that's been pushing it along. I now think my defects were a scaffolding for my drinking to keep it going. So if I was dishonest, it was because that was the only way to explain, you know, why I was late or why I didn't want to go to my family's reunions. How it is now is so different, and it keeps becoming different. A couple of years ago, when I retired, I started writing as a hobby. And during the pandemic, I grew to know a lot of people online who had webinars, and I joined a few groups that were very supportive and nice, and I didn't go anywhere that was felt toxic, and I started to learn how to write, and it's been very, very exciting for me, just switching from one kind of writing to another. And that's something that I probably always wanted to do. I was telling Truly, I wanted to do that in third grade. I wanted a cover around my reports, you know, that said Judy Fowler. And now I'm able to do it, and people like helping you. That's such a shock to me, that people like to help and that I can receive and not just give, give, give. You might wonder what happened to the husband. He is now married to another lady named Judy and they live in the same apartment. And I'm guessing she's got money. He was a very nice man, though, and he did put me to bed, and he did call the boss, and he did do all of that. He did that for 25 years. And when I got sober, we stuck it out for another 8 years. And then I told him I made it to menopause, but I'm not going to make it to death. And we agreed to part, and we only had a dog to share, and I got the dog. So that all worked out. He's very happy now. And when I went to New York once and felt kind of lonely, I told someone in AA, maybe I'll call David. And she said, leave him alone. That's your gift to him. Leave him alone. So anyway, but I did have a family that always wanted me to be part of the family. And I don't know about the rest of you if that's an issue with you, but I was determined that, you know, they are the problem with me. And then when I got sober, I didn't really want to see them. I didn't want them to know I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to know that I was in AA. I didn't want to know what their opinion of me was, and I was sure I couldn't stand them. And then about, I forget how many years, it was somewhere less than 10 years, my mother broke her shoulder up in Boston. She broke it on a cobblestone. Anyway, nobody in the family could go be with her to take her to physical therapy. And I was back in school by then, thanks to AA, you know, I was getting the master's I was always going to get, and I got a career out of it, and I retired from the career, and judges were there, friendly judges who were friends of mine that I was working with. It was amazing. what AA can do for a person who couldn't handle 2 days, 2 hours a day at work before. But so I said I would go up, and I was with my mother, and I remembered that in my first year I heard someone say, you know, I have 16 years and my mother is my best friend. And I remember telling somebody next to me, that'll never happen to me. And then I went up to help my mother, and I told my sponsor I probably won't need meetings all summer because it's so pretty up there. And she said, in that case, I'd like you to make a meeting every day. And I want you to get a Vermont sponsor. And who's going to take care of you? You're taking care of your mother. Who's going to take care of you? And I still feel that way about AA. Who's going to take care of me if I don't come to AA? Because you guys are the only ones who know how to take care of me. And I'm the only one who can pass on to you what you might be asking for in AA. And the 12 steps, just you get better and better with practice, and they've never steered me wrong. But anyway, at the end of that, my mother was my best friend. So who changed? And then I just came back from Florida, where both my sisters are living with their families and lots of children and new babies and all kinds of, and this would have been something I would have just gone like this, you know, 10 years ago. I'm busy. I have malaria. I can't come. And so I went down there, and they just acted like Santa Claus had just arrived. The babies were kissing me. Everyone was kissing me. Everybody was hugging me. Everybody wanted me to stay one more night, and I mean, it was a great, I did feel like Santa Claus, but it was amazing that they had become such nice people. I mean, I don't remember an argument. It was like they'd taken friendly pills, right? And, you know, then we said goodbye, and then after I got back, they called me, and I called them, and that was just a month ago. And it's just an example of applying this program, having a home group, going through the steps, passing the program on, welcoming people, and having AA be my primary purpose. It's my primary purpose. If I'm in love, if I just had a windfall, if I just lost money, if I just lost love, I still have a primary purpose. It's to stay sober and help another alcoholic when I can. And it's working. And the image that I could maybe leave somebody new with, but this is an old story again too, so come. This movie called Lost Horizon was old when I first watched it, so like it was old 60 years ago. And anyway, it was about some people in a plane, Americans in a plane, landed in Tibet in the snow, in the mountains, and were absolutely stranded and lost and hopeless. But then they found, like right over the hill, was this little perfect community, and it was called Shangri-La. And when they got inside it, everyone was beautiful, everything was sweet, everyone was thin, trim, happy, the children sang. And one or two people in Shangri-La wanted out. And one or two of the people who got stranded also wanted out eventually, after they got used to all the singing and the happiness. And they wanted to go back home and try to make their way back. And when they did leave Shangri-La, the one or two people who had lived there and wanted to get out crumbled. And it turned out they were like 2,000 years old.
Oh.
And they just, they died within steps of leaving Shangri-La. And, you know, sometimes people say to me, why do you keep going to AA? And I say, I can't leave Shangri-La. Right?
Yeah.
I'm young and I'm beautiful, and I'm here with you people, and you've solved every problem I ever had, which was one problem, I'm an alcoholic. And everything else has turned out to be a situation. And they all pass. So thank you so much for having us tonight and listening to my story, and I hope it helps somebody.